later in Macro Sunday.
Story which led me to pronounce the death of the 2% target was Jay Powell's behavior in March, where he clearly, didn't seem to care. And again, he's too smart. That's the thing with Lagarde, it's not always bright up there. But when you hear Powell say something stupid, you know it's deliberate. And I think when he was asked about, financial conditions being too loose, and he pretended that the question was about the Taylor rule, that tells you that fundamentally, if he has to make a trade-off between keeping the economy going, keeping the stock market up, and letting inflation, stay at that 3.5% range for a few years, he'll take the latter. And by the way,
you're listening to Macro Sunday, hosted by Andrea Stino. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Macro Sunday podcast. I'm Andrea Stino, the founder and CEO of Steno Research. And as per usual, I'm joined by you, Mikkel Rosenvold, in the studio. Welcome to you.
Thanks a lot.
You're our head of geopolitics here at Steno Research. And also my running mate, if that's a word for this podcast. Mikkel, we're going to talk a lot about dollar rates markets today. Mm-hmm. But we'll also spend some time discussing Scandinavia. We're based in Home Copenhagen, turf. Of course. Before I give the word to you, Mikkel, I'd like to say to the audience out there that I'm in Singapore next week. Mm-hmm. So if you're based in Singapore, whether you're an institutional manager, a family office manager, whatever, please hit me up on Bloomberg on Monday. We have some time left for a coffee or whatever you like. So Singapore in the week that follows this podcast.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, Andreas, we have a lot of ground to cover this week. We have an interview with Vincent Deluard of StoneX.
Yes.
A little later in the show. We're going to talk a little bit about Iran and Israel, of course, a little later. Let me just start with a couple of small nuggets of analysis that I've picked up from our shop over the past week. Markets are starting to agree on zero Fed cuts, we wrote. We're getting there, down to 1.5, 1.6 thereabouts. Yeah. Is that what's causing equities to be so sour?
Partially. We've had a retracement lower in equities because of a couple of technicalities, in my view. Remember that we are amidst the peak of the tax season in the US. So it's not out of the ordinary that we see a liquidity withdrawal from markets as the U.S. Treasury basically hoards cash. And why do they hoard cash right now? Well, because they're getting an inflow of tax. So basically, you could practically see this as a sign that some investors take profit and realize their tax, right? Mm-hmm. I guess that's at least a part of the reason here. Obviously, geopolitics play a major part in this as well. We saw how the pre-announcement of the attack on Israel sent shockwaves through equity markets. And then, of course, on the margin, it's not positive that dollar rates move in the direction they do, especially when the move is rapid. And it was very rapid after the inflation report paired with some of the trends seen in commodity space, also propping up inflation expectations, etc. But my overwhelming feeling and vibe right now is that we're close to oversold territory again in risk mm-hmm. assets, especially if the dust settles a little bit in the Middle East, and we can get back to that in a second.
Absolutely. I know you've been looking at, or we've been looking at the dollar as well, the trend in the dollar. You see some strong movement there. Could you give us some pointers on that?
Yeah. As soon as equity starts to sell off, we have this self-feeding process of rebalancing of FX hedges from the real money community, basically leading to a loop where equities sell off, the dollar strengthens on the back of rebalancing trends in FX hedges, and the strong dollar then basically sends spillovers to especially equity markets outside of the US, but also to a certain extent the US. So that's kind of a self-feeding loop until it is broken by something from the outside. that something from the outside could be some sort of truce, whatever it's called in the Middle East. We're not there yet, at least not by the time of the recording. That something from the outside could be a central bank admitting to a more dovish path because of turmoil in the market. And our quant tools are all screaming now that we're in oversold territory. So we just need that thing from the outside to sort of underpin developments again, and then we'll get back into a more positive vibe, I think. We're starting to see signs of it, by the way, towards the end of last week. Point being here that when we talk about the dollar, it is always relevant to look at these rebalancing flows in FX space. They are extremely important for the direction of the dollar, and we saw this major signal in our models and thankfully flagged that signal for clients, but also for our own portfolio ahead of that dollar move. But there's an interesting story that relates to this strength in the dollar, and that is the current gold rally. Yeah. You hosted Bob from Gold 123 a few weeks ago. Great guy. Does he like Bitcoin? No, but he loves gold at least. It was kind of a fun episode. The reason why I mentioned gold in relation to the US dollar is that, I mean, if you look at it historically, you would typically argue that a strong dollar would be bad news for commodities. The reason why it's not this time around is that we see strong inflows into gold, especially from Asians. And you could argue that gold almost works as a, I think you call it a pressure valve in plain English. So every time the dollar strengthens versus local FX in Asia, they jump on the opportunity to buy more gold to hedge against that weakness in the local currency. And that's been a major thing in China. I think we see flows from other Asian nations as well, but especially from China. And I would still argue that there is a weakness hidden beneath the hood in the current exchange rate between the US dollar and the Chinese yuan. They've continuously held the fixing substantially below spot levels to try and emphasize that while we're not going to allow things to run wild here, but at the same time, this has been kept as a status quo for quite a while. So the average Chinese investor or the average Chinese family office knows that there is an underlying selling pressure in the Chinese yuan that they're not sort of allowing to play out. And God knows when the authorities will allow that. Given the change of focus in their export portfolio to heavy manufacturing products, also an ownership of the entire supply chain in EVs, solar panels, and stuff like that. It could actually make sense for them to allow the currency to weaken even more to gain ground from an export perspective in Europe and in the US to the extent that they're allowed to. So I have full sympathy for that gold hedge trade if you're a nation. And I think currently the Europeans, and also clearly when we look at especially retail flows in the US, they're heavily underinvested in this hedge. It is a hedge, not an investment, but they're underinvested in it.
Interesting. Well, after the interview, we'll look into some of our recent portfolio moves and strategy. We'll look a lot more into Scandinavian FX as well.
But Miguel, I'd like to ask you, now that we're talking about gold, because obviously typically we see gold performing decently well during times of turbulence in geopolitics. So that's obviously also a reason why we've seen gold performing. I said initially that the something from the outside that could lead to an underpinning of risk assets again could be geopolitics. And you've been fairly vocal that we shouldn't expect a major escalation of the tensions between Iran and Israel. And so far, so good by the time of the recording. Yeah. So what are you watching here? I mean, could this escalate from here?
No, I doubt it. I mean, basically what we predicted from the Iranian attack was more or less what we got. The attack was designed to be large in scale, to seem large, but to be relatively harmless in effect. I mean, we had zero casualties, perhaps one casualty from the hundreds of drones and missiles that Iran sent against Israel. Iran must have known that Israel would shoot down at least, I would have guessed, 90 to 95%. The eventual shoot down rate was 99%. They will have known that based on, first and foremost, that this is a type of attack that Iran has developed in conjunction with Russia. Russia have been carrying out these combined missile drone attacks in Ukraine. Ukraine has had a shoot down rate of 40 to 60%. We know that Israel is much better prepared for this kind of attack. They were more or less warned.
It was pre-announced. More or less. Yeah.
The missiles and drones had to go over several countries. So, I mean, the Iranians knew that this wasn't going to be a bloodbath within Israel. And that's probably what they designed it not to be. In order to show to internally and to their partners that, yes, we've stood up for ourselves. We responded. But in a way that leaves Israel with no clear grounds, perhaps, for a response, or at least a dilemma internally. And that's what we're seeing right now. As we're recording this on Thursday, let's just be frank about that. Things can and may have changed before you hear this on Sunday. The Israeli government is in a dilemma because a lot of parties, including their main allies in the US, are pushing for the Israelis to stand down and not retaliate against this attack. And that's exactly what the Iranians wanted. That leads me to answer your question, to the conclusion that Iran wants no escalation from this. Israel most likely don't want an escalation for this. So this will likely be, we are getting closer to the end of this circle of violence. And that was essentially what we predicted a week ago.
So almost every Thursday, we release a shipping update with the numbers and the trends seen in the Red Sea, in the Suez Canal. And I mean, the short story is that nothing has changed. And that's obviously bad news. Yeah. No news is bad news here, because it essentially means that shipping routes are still south of Africa mainly. We're talking about delays. We're talking about elevated shipping freight rates. So, Mikkel, given this tension between Iran and Israel, are there any solutions to the Red Sea issues meanwhile?
There are two solutions, basically. The one is a peace between Israel and Hamas. That is still the logical way to end this. I don't expect the Houthis to keep up these attacks after that conflict is resolved. That's looking really difficult right now. There are talks, but they're looking very difficult. The second option is what the US is also working on right now, which is a direct deal with the Houthis. Negotiations have been very tough. The US are not used to negotiating. They don't have very many avenues of contact to the Houthis or the Iranians. But it seems now that the US have one grand bargaining chip, which is to remove the Houthis from the US terror list. That would be huge for the Houthis, make it much easier for them to travel the globe and basically try and establish their own little government in Yemen. Obviously, a humiliation for the US to sell this terror list. But it might be worth the price to get global shipping back and get global trade flowing again as we used to. So that's my little hope. I've been too optimistic in the past when trying to predict when this crisis will be over. I'm hoping before summer, either by one or the other solution. But it's right now it's still very much a deadlock.
Yeah, it is. If you want to read our takes on the geopolitics of this shipping question, if you want to read our takes on the dollar and why we see this pressure valve or release valve in gold in Asian flows, go to stenoresearch.com. We have you covered in there, and you can use the coupon code GEO30.
Yes, GEO30, basically.
To get 30% off your yearly subscription. Mm-hmm. And this is a limited offer, so go use it as soon as possible if you want to secure your 30% off. Mikkel, I think the tensions in the Middle East make for a almost a perfect bridge to the interview with Vincent Deloy. Vincent is a chief strategist within the macro commodity space for StoneX Group. StoneX is obviously present within the commodity space, and Vincent is clearly an inflationist, probably partially because of this geopolitical picture. So let's introduce Vincent to the Macro Sunday podcast.
Thank you.
It's now my great pleasure to introduce Vincent Deloire of StoneX Group to the Macro Sunday podcast. It's great to see you, Vincent.
I'm very happy to be here. It's been overdue and it's a good time to catch up.
You've been fairly vocal over the past year on the inflation cycle in the US. For those of you who already read the stuff released by StoneX, it's been crystal clear that you basically declared the 2% target dead. So what are your main arguments behind the inflation cycle never returning to what we're used to in the US?
Well, so there is a kind of a long-term story about kind of the fundamentals for it, which I can get into. And then there's a short-term story which led me to pronounce the death of the 2% target was Jay Powell's behavior in March, where he clearly didn't seem to care. And again, he's too smart. That's the thing with Lagarde, you know, like it's not always bright up there. But when you hear Powell say something stupid, you know it's deliberate. And I think when he was asked about, financial conditions being too loose, and he pretended that the question was about the Taylor rule, that tells you that fundamentally, you know, if he has to make a trade-off between keeping the economy going, keeping the stock market up, and letting inflation, you know, stay at that 3.5% range for a few years, he'll take the latter. And by the way, as far as I'm concerned, I would actually agree with that. I mean, I don't think it's worth, you know, risking a massive depression, a huge currency crisis. I mean, you're going to create a lot of misery in order to get back to a target that kind of ties in this kind of longer term framework that I want to do. The 2% target is a fairly recent invention, right? I think it was some guy in New Zealand in the early 80s. They had inflation problem back then. Central banks didn't have price targets. If you look at the Federal Reserve Act, it's just price stability, which, I mean, any normal person should understand as 0% inflation, not, 2% core PC, whatever. But so in the 80s, like, oh, well, he was asked about it and he didn't know what to answer. He said 2%. Why? Not too high, not too low. That's about as much science as there is to 2% target. And then it was taken by the Canadians and the British, and only, I think, by Bernanke in 2014. Officially, even though they were probably casually targeting it before. And my impression is that 2% target was really a product of circumstances. We had what I called it the three big shocks of the 90s. One was a demographic shock where you had your boomers and your millennials all working. And then as the decade progressed with 2010, the millennial coming. So your two largest generations are working together. So that increases your production function, that increases your net savings, that reduces dependency ratios. You have, of course, the huge shock of China. I mean, you had all these papers on the late 90s on the Walmart effect, removing 1% of the US CPI. Really, it was a Chinese effect, right? I mean, if you look at the CPI, you can see it break down basically in the late 90s, where your core goods start falling and then your service keep rising by 3-4% a year. Which kind of makes me think that the true underlying inflation in the U.S. economy was always at 3.4. If you look at things that Americans actually produce, like higher education, healthcare, ski resorts in Vail, that's always been going up by 3-4%. And it's only because we had this shock from China coming in with an extremely undervalued exchange rate, and then all of East Asia doing the same thing after the 1998 crisis. The central bankers were basically just here. And the third shock, of course, was the tequila crisis in Mexico in 1994-1995. In the next decade, you'd have 10 million working-age Mexican crossing the border, really lowering the cost of labor. Minimum wage in the U.S. did not increase for 40 years. So, basically, you had cheap capital, cheap goods, cheap labor. Yeah, of course, you're going to be able to hit that 2% target without doing anything, which is fantastic for central bankers. So they just... I think that's why they moved to the 2% target, because it suited the circumstances and they took the credit, of course, especially, Greenspan was notoriously quite good at taking credit for everything good happening in the world. Now we're in a different environment. That's the old sentence by Keynes, what do you do when circumstances changes? Well, I changed my opinions. And I think we're at the point where It's not just the crazies like me that are talking about the end of the 2%, but you even see like, man, I was shocked. Larry Fink, you know, like, I mean, if you can think of anyone who better embodies the consensus on every topic than the world's largest asset manager, Jerry came out and said, you know what? If we get down to 2.9 and we still have 3.5% inflation and no recession, cool, take the win. Yeah. And I think that thinking is spreading very fast, and it's probably, I mean, Powell doesn't come publicly with it, but it was as good as it could get there when he basically discarded three bad inflation prints, and just tell the market, I'm going to be chill about rates.
Yeah. So you speak a lot about wages in your structural views on inflation. You mentioned the influx of Mexicans as one of the structural forces keeping inflation down ahead of the spike that we've seen in 2020 and that wave from the late 90s into the 2000s. When we look at the labor market right now, I'd like to take your opinion on that as well. We obviously see a lot of focus on the border question again because of an influx of immigrants. Yes. But it seems like the Federal Reserve is very focused on getting that balance in the labor market right. So on one side, we have early retirements, and on the other side, we have an influx of immigrants. So how do you see that balance in the labor market right now?
Right. So it may be, my inflation obsession, like, everything that's longer than larger than it's large looks like, something else. I mean, for me, everything seems inflationary. But I'm going to say I view this dynamic as very inflationary. You're absolutely right that we had a shock that is comparable or even greater in absolute number than the immigration in the 90s from the southern border crisis. Last year, we had 4 million new Americans. 4 million. I mean, can you imagine that? I mean, this is probably, or larger than Copenhagen, I'm sure, coming in, you have, 300,000 apprehension at the southern border every month. And these are just the apprehension. So who knows what the actual number is? And these are, you see from the videos, these are all working age men. And you see, these are coming in an economy where the labor market was insanely tight, right? Remember, we had this job opening to an unemployed ratio that was north of 2. This is exactly what we needed. Now, I'm not going into conspiracy theories or whatever. I'm just saying in 2021-22, after COVID, immigration dropped, people retired, we had a labor market imbalance, and then we had a lot of people crossing the southern border. And it did ease the labor market a little bit. Like you look at your job vacancies to an unemployed ratio, it's dropped, still much higher than pre-COVID, by the way, but it's dropped. Some signs of, it suggests that wage growth is cooling, especially in the bottom part. Like construction, of course, is slowing it a bit because of rate hikes. So, but what I find more stunning is that it's still tight despite this. Mm. Despite 4 million people crossing the border, we still have an unemployment rate at a 50-year low. We still have 4-5% wage gains. And I think the reason it's still tight is because the underlying let's call it native U.S. labor market, is shrinking. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the chart that show that pretty much all the job creating since COVID have gone to immigrants. And this is not like some sort of a grand conspiracy to, keep out, waspy Americans at labor force. It's just because of the population structure. And especially this early retirement. If you look at the participation rate for men is lower than it was pre-COVID. The participation from primary training in the U.S. probably one of the scariest charts you have since in the early 70s, just keeps dropping. And then on top of that, now we have what we really shouldn't be having, which is older workers leaving the labor force. You would want the exact opposite, right? We have this kind of global demographic crisis everywhere where, people are living longer, they haven't saved enough, so the obvious solution is you need to work longer. Well, in the U.S., it's going the other way. We are about 2 percentage points below where we were before COVID on older workers' participation. And these are all you boomers. Now, I would argue that's the product of Powell inflating asset prices, right? I mean, the houses is worth a lot. The stock portfolio is up. So these guys are like, I'm just going to go chill on my boat or my house in Florida. And you see that especially in kind of blue-collar professions. Like a lot of boomers are like, they own like landscaping company or a roofing company, and these people are leaving. So it's fortunate to some extent that we have new people coming in to replace them, but that's just basically keeps you in check. And I don't believe for a second that you can structurally, even in the US, which has a much greater tolerance for immigration than Europe, you cannot have 4 million people come every year. I mean, this is no, you know, probably late Roman Empire, you know, like that had the same kind of like inflation, immigration dynamic, and, you know, that ended with, you know, the sack of Rome by the Goths. I mean, that will come down. And to me, that will probably come down as early as November if we see Trump elected. Mm-hmm. You get that 4 million number fall to almost zero, which is what it was during the Trump years. And then you have to contemplate the effect, I mean, on inflation. Plus, also these 4 million people who came in last year, they're buying homes, they're buying fridge, they're buying cars. So mm-hmm. you're going to have a boost to demand. The supply is no longer going to come in. And imagine if on top of that, we throw, you know, a 10% across the board tariff and maybe a 60% one on China, and we do some tax cuts. I mean, this is going to go back, you know. I mean, you keep looking at this chart of the 70s, and I know the metaphor is overused and whatever, but it does track nicely with the waves, right? And it does seem like, you know, this is, you had your first wave, now we're at the through. We haven't come back to 2%. In the 70s, we did come back lower. That's the only difference. And then you can see it come back up. So, yes, maybe, you know, maybe I see everything as inflationary, but I think there is a very strong case to be made for a second wave of inflation after the November election.
If we consider the politics of this, and we have to, given that it's an election year, you mentioned Powell's presser in March as an example of the political nature of the Federal Reserve this year. So despite this resurgence in inflation that we've obviously seen so far this year, could they still decide to cut interest rates? What's your view on that?
I mean, it's the important question right now. It's a lot easier for me to say what they should do than what they will do.
Yeah.
Obviously, given my views on inflation, and I think monetary policy is accommodative, the neutral rate is above where we are. So they should at least leave it as there is, if not hike it.
Yeah.
Now, what they will do is a different question. And I might even, I mean, for the longer, this is hard for me to say because, you know, for 3 years, basically my trade was simple, fade the rate cuts.
Yeah.
And you could just make money with your, just like, oh my God, it was like a gravy train. You know, the market was pricing 7, you knew, I mean, you know, it was going to be 0. I mean, you could just make money just month after month. And, you know, because the rates market wasn't getting the memo. Now it's a bit harder. Like I think there is a risk that Powell actually does cut at least once. And then on the timing, yeah. I mean, there's only 2 meetings, really. It's got to be June or September, because after that, it's the election. It's going to look bad. I mean, I think it looks bad in general, but, you know, less bad, I guess, to do it in June and September. And because he's really talked, I mean, a lot, and needlessly too. Like, you know, why are they running around, running their mouth? At the beginning of the year, I'm like, oh, maybe they know something I don't know. Maybe they, like, no, they were just running around and telegraphing their intentions. So that's the part. I think, right, they promised 2, almost 3 in the summer of economic projection. That's probably too much. The market now has them at like 1.5. Mm. My guess is there's going to be 1. Kind of like, I think it's going to be like a Trichet move, you know, like the famous, the reverse Trichet, yeah, you know, yeah. Like, so the OJ Trichet is your hike rate when the global economy is in this global recession. And then you do it again in 2011 when the sovereign debt crisis hit. I think maybe, I don't know, the Riksbank is also pretty.
Yeah.
I know they did that too, like, but they probably has a Swedish name that's too hard for me to remember. But I think we're going to have a reverse cliche where, you know, just to maintain consistency, you do the move that you said you do, even though everything points in the other direction. Yeah. And then 2 months later, you gotta completely invert it and you look like a fool.
That sounds like volatile times ahead in interest rate markets, in case. I'd like to get your take on whether this is a US-centric story or whether you see some of the same patterns unfolding outside of the US. To take the very anecdotal example here in Europe, we see more and more Chinese EVs on the roads right now, both in Copenhagen, but also elsewhere when I visit some of the capitals here. So it seems like that deflation that we've obviously seen in China is impacting Europe more than the US. What's your take on the global inflation picture, not the US inflation picture?
Yeah, I think you summarized it perfectly. You have a... you know, it's a yin and a yang, right? I mean, you have one inflationary force, you know, and action creates this reaction, and you have the emergence of a deflationary force against it. And it's almost the opposite from, you know, before, you know, in early 2000 when China was creating inflation by consuming, you know, half of every commodity out there. Now it's the exact opposite. You see China emerge as a deflationary force. What you said about Europe is even truer in emerging markets. I mean, as you know, I spent a lot of time in Latam, and it's a different continent than it was, you know, 20 years ago. Like, you see all these Chinese cars there, and these are, you know, I mean, sub $10,000 EVs. I mean, this is fantastic. And, you know, we don't see them as much in the US because we're married to Tesla. But yeah, China is definitely exporting a lot of deflation. Basically, it's the policy, the three news, electric vehicles, batteries, and solar panels. And, you know, of course, it's destroying European industrial base. Yes, that is the offset. So the way I would characterize it, rather, would be more of a developed market phenomenon versus broad. I don't like the distinction, but yeah, developed versus emerging. In Europe, yes, we have the disinflationary shock from, and it might get worse, by the way, if we see the Trump tariffs. Guess where all these Chinese exports are going to go, right? I mean, they're going to go to the common market, and you know, we'll send some strongly worded words about, Chinese competition, but as usual, will be ineffective. But this is more an accident, right? I mean, I think the dynamic in Europe are also inflationary for the very same reason. I mean, which is demography. I mean, it's there's a book, The Great Reversal, written by some Bank of England economists, and the main thesis is: past a certain point, aging becomes inflationary. Right? When you start to age, it's deflationary because you have fewer kids, and I think you're aware kids are expensive. but then, you know, if you don't have kids, well, you know, you can save a lot of money, right? Twinks, two income, no kids. That's where Europe was for the 90s, 2000s, 2010s, low dependency ratio. But then as this generation kind of goes into retirement, if you think about your production function as labor plus capital, your capital goes down, so your labor goes down, and that puts pressure on pretty much everything. And you see that in Europe, right? I mean, we basically have a recession in Germany. I mean, it's an ongoing thing now. I mean, it's getting maybe a bit better, but whatever. France is only growing because the government is, you know, spending 60% of GDP. But generally, it's, you know, Europe is flatlining to going down. And yet, the unemployment rate is at a 60-year low. And if you go, I'm sure you're aware, I mean, my family is in the French countryside. I mean, there's just this shortages of labor. Like, you cannot find a roofer, you cannot find a plumber because the people are retired. And whoever is going to come in these small French, Italian, Spanish villages is going to be able to name their price. So I think over time, Europe is in that inflationary train as well. I suspect Japan is going to be there also. And then on the other side, yes, you have China that will be in some ways somewhat like you know, if we go back with the overused 1970s metaphor, China is a little bit like Europe and Germany in the 70s when the US was really inflating, and then the Deutsche Mark, the Swiss franc, the Netherlands, the Gilde were kind of anchors of value because the Bundesbank was not, you know, following the lead of the Fed back then. So yeah, I think it's going to be a split phenomenon. And then the big question, of course, where EMs are going to fall. My impression is EMs are actually doing quite fine. You know, your Brazil, your Mexico, your India, your Indonesia, they're kind of able to play both sides, enjoy the stimulus from the US. You clearly see that in Mexico, where, you know, the French shoring, and at the same time, they get the cheap consumption goods from China. So they have, really, this is very stimulative to their economy, because you have a strong demand, but the inflationary pressures are kept in check because you're able to import very cheap stuff from China.
Yeah. So my final question for you, Vincent, is you travel LATAM a lot, and it seems to me like, especially Mexico, but maybe LATAM broadly speaking, is quite a consensus positive view out there. Yeah. We see a lot of positive trades, especially in Mexico. So do you think that trend remains intact, that we should be positive on LATAM because of this situation?
Yeah, you start to see tremors, right? Like an earthquake, like or 2 days ago, like at like 4 p.m., like the Mexican peso, the Brazilian real were down like huge. And this is like... basically carry trades that, you know, everybody's in, and when they unwind, it's hard. And yeah, I could certainly see it. I mean, it was so easy to do for so long, right? I mean, you'd get like, you know, 12% overnight, 13% in Brazil, 12% in Mexico, you know, the fundamentals were glorious, right? Mexico, the political situation is more or less stable. The economy is growing fine. You had the super peso, right? I mean, you could see it go from 24 against the USD to 16, 17, which is, even I as kind of a bull, I thought that was a little too rich. So yeah, the trade is overcrowded. I mean, in my defense, I said it before, it was cool. Like in early 2021, there were not that many peso or real bulls out there. Now, yeah, I agree with you. It's become more of a consensus trade. Surely, I think it has potential to reverse because of positioning. But how are the, you know, with time, especially when it comes to Mexico, I think this is really structural, and it's just almost like a size argument. You see it physically. I mean, I was in China in the early 2000s, and you know, one thing that strikes anyone is just how big China is, right? I mean, it's huge. Like you go to this massive industrial park, whatever, and then now the equivalent is Nuevo León in Mexico, the region around Monterrey, right by the Texan border. And like, you know, actually the entire Chinese economy is probably a Chinese province. And, you know, you can't, you know, 3/4 of Mexico, you can't invest because the infrastructure is not there. You're going to be in the jungle. You have the mountains in the middle. So it's only a very small part of Mexico where you can actually build your factories and, you know, Tesla went in there and so forth. So if you're going to squeeze, you know, like all of China into this tiny funnel, you're going to create a lot of pressure, and that pressure is going to pop up the exchange rate. So I think the super peso probably corrects a little bit, but over time, it's still, I'd much prefer, to be in Mexican fixed income than US.
I like that funnel analogy. I think that made a lot of sense to me also, sort of from a anecdotal perspective. Vincent Deloire of StoneX Group, it was such a pleasure to have you here on Macro Sunday podcast. And I hope to see you back during the year, because we have a lot of inflation to talk about in 6 months' time, if you're right.
I would love to. Thank you, Andreas.
Thank you. Back from the interview with Vincent Deloire of StoneX Group, Miguel. We've had two guys in a row saying that inflation will be sticky, and maybe stickier, I mean, higher than what we've already seen in the US. I have sympathy for that view, and I guess, given that reflation story that still seems to be unfolding, we, by the way, received decent numbers from the manufacturing sector in the US again last week. So, I mean, everything is playing out according to that playbook that we've been very early on and we've made a lot of money on, basically from the latter parts of last year and into the early innings of this year. And the only thing that annoys me now, and you know I'm a contrarian by heart, is that it is relatively easy to find common ground with a lot of people out there on this story. So the question is, when is this re-inflation story baked in? I mean, should we get a solution in the Red Sea? That will obviously pull things in the opposite direction, right? Should we get a truce between Israel and Hamas? Also on the margin, pulling things in a disinflationary direction. With China really firing on all cylinders on their exports of cheap goods, it at least seems like this inflation story is more or less over in Europe from now. So we don't see this inflation story around the globe, basically. No. It is very US-centric right now.
Absolutely, absolutely. Partially because they don't import these cheap Chinese goods on the same level that we do here in Europe. So, absolutely. I mean, it's a matter of getting the timing right on that one. And it's the divergence that we've been talking so much about between the US and Europe is really remarkable at the moment.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, Andreas, I would like to get back to our home turf of Scandinavia. You issued an analysis on the Swedish and Norwegian corner. Take us through. What's the situation?
So a piece of anecdotal evidence before we get to the Norwegian and Swedish market. I know that I will bore some of the listeners with Scandinavian stuff. But the funny thing is that when I travel the world, I mean, when I go to Asia as next week, they love to hear my takes on Sweden and Norway. If I go to Sweden to talk about Sweden, I'm Danish. But
don't do that,
right? No. I mean, so the good thing about being Danish and trading Scandinavian markets is that the Danish market is boring as hell. I mean, nothing happens because we have a pseudo Euro setup, right? So I'm allowed to look at Scandinavia from the outside. And I have no home bias, so I can actually be negative on Norway and Sweden, while local analysts struggle to be that often. Point being here that, I mean, I've worked with the Norwegian Central Bank through my career in Nordic investment banks. We have a very, very good take on the Norwegian rate path on a daily basis. We've basically proxy modeled it. So go look at stenoresearch.com if you're interested in Scandinavian stuff. You don't find that independent assessment of Scandinavia anywhere else than stenoresearch.com. We also obviously cover that for institutional clients on Bloomberg. Point being here that the Norwegian rate path right now, it's been repriced, say, 15 basis points up since the last meeting in March. But when we look at the live modeling of these 6-7 subcomponents that they actually have in their rate path model, that's wrong. I mean, they should have repriced it a little bit lower. And I think that will surprise right about everyone when we get to that rate meeting, rates meeting in June in Norway. So that's a potential strong case to look into. In Sweden, it seems baked in that we get a rate cut already in May. I have my doubts. We had a guy listening to the governor from the Riksbank at Nordea in Denmark a week ago. And I mean, he still seems split between May and June. So this expectation that the Swedish Riksbank will be the first of the larger, outside of Switzerland, at least larger European central banks to move, I have my doubts around that. So let's see. So in terms of portfolio moves on the back of this, we have to admit that we took a loss in our bet on the stronger Norwegian crown versus the dollar. So we were partially wrong-footed in that dollar move over the past few weeks. But besides that, we've had the right lean into commodities. We've had the right lean into stuff linked to materials, stuff that you use in the real world, right? Yeah. And that's exactly the lean that you need to have. as long as the manufacturing sector in the US is rebounding, silver is a very strong case in this environment still. if you're not buying into the new Trump meme stock, we have a small position in that just for the fun of it. And it's kind of the highlight of the day at the office to see whether it's up 50 or down 50 percent, that is. That it's a crazy stock. And then we've also been stopped out of our position in South Korea because of currency developments mainly, but also partially because of local equity developments. So we've had the right lean. We've taken a couple of stops, and we're currently contemplating whether the dust settles enough in the geopolitical space to add to the risk picture of our portfolio into next week. We're currently not there yet. But stay tuned if you want to follow our trade ideas, because we've basically been sitting on our hands because of this Iran-Israel stuff.
Absolutely. So this might be just the time to remind everyone that these are our analysis. Our trade ideas might be sometimes...
Sometimes it may be good, sometimes it may be shit.
Thank you to Gennaro Gattuso, a former AC Milan player, for this disclaimer. And... let me just conclude by saying this has been one of the best weeks in my life, essentially. Barcelona out of Champions League, Real Madrid beating Manchester City. well, could be better than that. I'll see you Madridistas out there at Santiago Bernabeu for the semifinal. That's at least my plan for now.
That's great stuff. We'll be back next week with perhaps a little bit more on the Bitcoin halving, more on potential moves into risk assets.
And then we're joined by Marco Papic, one of the best geopolitical analysts on the globe, if you ask me.
Great stuff. Thanks for listening or watching on YouTube.
See you out there.